This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. Black Lives Matter. That phrase is on T-shirts worn today by about 2,000 local teachers. Some of these teachers also have lesson plans that deal with race and inequality. Here to tell you about that is our education reporter, Ann Dornfeld, who covered the event today. Hi, Ann.
How's it going?
It's good. You covered that event at the Highline School District today, not in Seattle. Why is that?
Well, I had planned to visit a handful of Seattle schools, but yesterday the district told me that they were not going to let media into buildings. They said that they didn't want to disrupt the learning. Luckily, I knew of a school in the Highline District that was also holding a Black Lives Matter in school day, so I spent the morning in classes there.
We also talked today with a spokesperson for the Seattle School District who didn't want to come on the air and talk about it. So I'm asking you, for listeners who don't know, what's behind this T-shirt wearing event today?
Last month, John Muir Elementary in South Seattle announced that its teachers were all going to wear Black Lives Matter shirts to school on the same day that several hundred black men planned to greet students with high fives at the school door, kind of a pep rally. The news spread to some conservative websites that have a national audience, and the day before the event, there was a bomb threat called into the school. So the district canceled the event, but it went on kind of in smaller numbers. A teacher at Hamilton Middle School asked teachers at her school if they'd like to wear Black Lives Matter shirts in solidarity with the Muir teachers in the school. And that plan spread throughout the district. When the teachers union voted to endorse a Black Lives Matter in school day, the district got on board, and so did the Seattle PTSA.
Have you talked to, speaking of PTSA, have you talked to parents and students about this teacher event?
Yeah. I think that most of the parents I spoke to were supportive. Some parents really wanted to know what was going on. They felt like they weren't hearing enough about what the curriculum was going to be. Initially, the plan was teachers would wear the shirts to school, but then it kind of grew into lesson plans designed to focus on issues of race and equity. And so some parents felt like there wasn't enough communication about what those lessons would include. And there's also some concern from some folks that Black Lives Matter doesn't just represent a sentiment, but represents a political organization they may or may not agree with the tactics of. So some folks were concerned that teachers were being too outwardly political. I spoke to the principal at White Center Heights that I visited today, and she said, yes, it's political, that the act of teaching is political, and that she doesn't want herself or her teachers to shy away from political issues when they matter so much to students.
Interesting. The act of teaching is political. Well, let's talk about the lesson plans that you mentioned. What do you know about what lessons are going along with this event?
Well, I'll tell you about whose classes I visited today. I went to a first grade class. They were reading a bell hooks poem made into a kid's short story about the color of your skin and what that says or does not say about what's inside you. And the kids were discussing that. It was very sweet. One kid said that my skin is brown, but people don't know that inside my bones are white. It was sweet listening to their conversations. I also visited a fifth grade class where there was a lot of talk about police brutality. They were very concerned about the role of police in society. And why do we have police if they're going to be shooting innocent people? So I think the teachers were really focused on different things in different classrooms. I know of a teacher who was creating films with his students. He's a middle school teacher and helping them find images and poetry related to the Black experience. So I think they're focusing on Black kids and people of color, but they're trying to make it relevant to all of their students.
So this is not a district-wide, grade-by-grade curriculum. It's very much up to the individual teacher?
Right, yeah. There were some curricula that were suggested, a long list for teachers to kind of go through and see what resonated with them or what really kind of fit into the context of their existing lesson plans.
We've been talking about the wearing of Black Lives Matter T-shirts today by hundreds, maybe a couple of thousand local teachers and the lesson plans that go along with it. Anything else you want to let us know about today's event, Ann?
Well, I'm going to have a feature this evening, so if parents want to know what was going on in their kids' classrooms, they can hear what I have at least one school.
Okay, we'll find out what happened today. And, you know, we'd love to hear from you, too, you, the listener, about what your experience, whether you're a parent, a teacher, administrator, a student, an interested party. Let us know what you took away from today's event as the conversation filters through our region. Ann Dornfeld is KUOW's education reporter. Ann, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to to KUOW's The Record, and talking about today's curriculum, we said that it's somewhat teacher by teacher, and we do know that some teachers developed a lesson plan for today that includes part of this talk from astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Here's a bit of it.
The fact that I wanted to be a scientist and astrophysicist was hands down the path of most resistance through the forces of nature and forces of society. Anytime I expressed this interest, teachers would say, don't you want to be an athlete? No, don't you want to? I want to become something that was outside of the paradigms of expectation of the people in power.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson remembering how people in power talked about his blackness when he was growing up. Well, our next guest thinks about how people talk about whiteness, especially their own whiteness. Robin DiAngelo has been a consultant for more than 20 years on issues of race and social justice. She goes around, talks with businesses, organizations, and she says it can be a challenge to get white people to understand that they're white and to realize why that even matters. Robin DiAngelo told me how she begins her training sessions.
So one of the techniques I use to open my sessions is I talk about my own race immediately, right? Draw people's attention to my race, and then ask them to go around the group and to say what their racial identity is. And immediately it puts white people out of our racial comfort, because we are rarely ever asked to identify our race, and we certainly have never been taught that it's relevant or has any meaning. So here I am.
Why does that matter, this idea that we don't get asked about our race?
Because what it reinforces is that we are just universal people, we are just universal human beings, right? And that other people have a race. Somebody has a race, but not me. And so when we're always putting, you know, a racial qualifier in front of a person of color, the black director, the Asian reporter, then we reinforce this idea of that we're individuals, but they're always members of their group. So the right to be seen as an individual actually becomes a privilege, because not everybody is granted that.
If a group member doesn't identify as white, what do they say they are?
Oh, they will say human. Sometimes you preempt that by saying, okay, just a quick check. Do we have any cyborgs in the room? No, no robots. We're all okay. So we're all human. All right. So we can just establish that. Now, what is your racial identity? So depending on my mood, I might preempt that move. They may also say I'm European American, or I'm Italian, or I'm Irish.
What's wrong with that if they're Italian-American.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm Italian-American. But we are talking about race, and we live in a society in which race matters profoundly. And I don't move through the world having an Italian experience in the U.S. I have a white experience in the U.S., and we have to get honest about it and grapple with what that means. And oftentimes, people who say, oh, well, I'm Irish, really, let's face it, they're Irish on St. Patrick's Day. But that's not actually the identity they kind of lead their movement through the world from.
Why does it matter that they don't go through life as Italians in this world? What's important about that?
Well, it matters because let's talk about the melting pot for a moment. So I was raised to see, oh, the great melting pot. The U.S. was this great melting pot where everybody came and melted. But the reality is only European ethnics melted. So, yes, Italians and Irish were once seen as similar to black, right? No Italians allowed, no Jews, no Irish.
Don't bother applying for a job.
Right. But once you assimilate, drop your accent, maybe modify your food a little bit, you meld into whiteness, quite frankly. And it was the reward for dropping that ethnic identity and getting to become white. People of color were never able to melt into that pot and only be seen as individuals or as members of a really specific ethnic group. They're always seen in racialized terms. Eduardo Bonilla Silva is a sociologist who writes about race, and he says people of color could never melt into the pot. They could be used as the wood to fire the pot. And I love that. What he's implying is that in order for me to be white, somebody has to not be white. And so in so many ways, my identity depends on the presence of people of color.
Well, isn't that then a reason not to call each other white? If I say I'm white, it's like, oh, I'm no color at all, and you're the colored people. What's helpful about that? We all have a different skin tone.
Right. Well, first, it's much, much deeper than our skin tone, right? So it's really kind of how we're socialized to see ourselves. It's the way that we engage around race, what we see, what we don't see, what we're invested in, what society grants us. So even though we talk about it as just skin color, it's much, much deeper than that in terms of the ways that we're socialized. But we don't live in a world in which race doesn't matter. And so to pretend that we're in that world actually just hides and obscures how it matters. And unfortunately, that benefits those that are privileged by the way race matters. So it serves me to carry on as if it has no meaning, because then I don't have to grapple with the ways my race advantages me.
Help me understand how this plays out in my own home, Robin. I really don't talk about white and black with my kids. We might talk about, if it comes up, darker skin or lighter skin, and they know about Martin Luther King. It's very simplified, but I don't want to set them up to think of human beings as being opposites. Like black, you're black, I'm white.
Well,
what's wrong with that?
Sadly, they learn very early that human beings are set up as opposites. So think about boys and girls. Do you think any child doesn't know that boys and girls are very different, that it's very, very important which one they are, and that they not be confused? And a lot of what you, I hope, would do as a parent would be help them challenge those boxes. But to pretend as if the boxes aren't there is not going to help your child. So race matters. And children by age 3 or 4, there's lots of great research on this, by age 3 or 4, they know how it matters. And to put it really bluntly, they know that it's better to be white. And unfortunately, when we pretend like that's not happening, we leave them at the effect of that message with no coping skills to resist it. So they internalize it, but they also learn to deny it. We need to be real about what's going on in the world. I'm sure there are lots of the issues you would address. I would like to think you would talk about domestic violence. And if you had a daughter in particular, right, you would teach her that she should never or never has to endure certain kinds of treatments. And if you had a son, you would want to make sure he understood that he's not free to just proceed with girls any way he wants, right? We know that we have to help them with this. And when it comes to race, we just want to pretend that nothing's happening and that the best way to address it is to ignore it.
How about a middle ground where I really do talk to my oldest about privilege and skin color? I just haven't put it in black-white terms. That seems to be a relic that it would be nice if we got past this. First of all, the kids know that somebody isn't black and they're not white literally, but also I don't want to set them up to think of people, as I say, as opposites. How do I play that middle ground?
I mean, it's very, very challenging, right? And if we had, you know, figured it out, we'd be somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I just have to reiterate that not addressing it is not the way they're going to kind of understand that nothing's happening. You also have to ask yourself, from what racial position are you proceeding as a parent, right? And it's worth reflecting on, who does it serve to want to proceed as if these things don't matter? Do you think that tends to be what parents of color say or think?
No, that they're, I don't think
right.
that.
So that there's something in there for us. There's a little red flag. Wait a minute. This is probably not a universal sentiment. It is probably most particularly a white sentiment, and therefore it's functioning in a way that I should look at and grapple with, right? When I'm trying to figure out how something works, or it's very hard to ever get to true or false or right or wrong or good or bad. And so I ask how it functions. Who's most likely to say that and what does it serve? So human nature is a common argument I hear. It's just human nature. Someone has to be on top. Right?
Oh.
And I suppose if you look across the recorded history, it certainly appears that there have always been those who dominate. And yet, who is most likely to say that domination is just human nature? Those on the top or those on the bottom? It is rarely a narrative of those on the bottom. And if we also look across recorded history, we can see that striving for justice and overcoming domination is just as old.
It's also
natural.
Human nature.
Exactly. So what side do I want to be on that, right? And who does it serve, right? Which narrative serves what? So this idea that the best way to have our children be, you know, so-called open-minded is to not talk about race as if it mattered, really just serves those of us who have been able to proceed as if it doesn't matter.
Will you give me an example of how white people acting like, despite what's happened over hundreds and thousands of years, suddenly race doesn't matter, how that functions to perpetuate racism? How does that work?
Well, one of the challenges is that we are not able to trace our history into the present. So one, we actually aren't taught really good, clear history. I mean, there were hundreds of years of our history was founded in human enslavement. To not grapple with that as deeply and complexly as we discuss lots of other Declaration of Independence, you know, all of these things that we study, does not prepare us to understand how we came to be in the moment we're at. But we also have to be able to trace it into the present. So there's this disconnect. One, we don't even know our history, but two, we see all of this as in the past. It serves us not to look at how race has shaped our lives. It serves us not to look at how we've been advantaged by our race. To have to look at that challenges our very identities as good people. And that's been one of the most effective adaptations of racism post-civil rights, is to make being a good moral person and complicity with racism mutually exclusive. So that what I hear, if you suggest that I'm complicit with racism or that I'm gaining advantage by nothing that I'm aware I'm doing, you've basically given me a deep moral insult by suggesting I'm not a good person. And since I'm consciously against racism and unaware of these advantages, I'm going to put all my energy into defending my character. And we can see this everywhere. It's what I call white fragility, right? This incredible...
You actually coined that now famous phrase, white fragility.
Yeah. You see this incredible defensiveness and this need to deflect and deny and explain away everything but the deep lifelong reflection that we need to be doing in a society that is so separate and unequal. And that's the other piece. You're talking about your children, but odds are you probably are raising them in segregation, as most white people raise their children in segregation. So we tell them that everyone's equal, but we don't live our lives as if that's actually the truth, right? We don't live our lives together. We don't seek out to build those relationships across race. And the fundamental message is that there isn't really any value in doing that. Those are the deeper messages our children are getting.
Robin DiAngelo developed the City of Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative Anti-Racism Training. So what do you want to say to her and her teaching partners who educate people about race and social justice? Send me your question, your story, your disagreement. You can be anonymous if you like. Write to us at record@kuow.org or give us a call, 206-221-3663, 221-3663, because this conversation is going to continue. I'll talk more with Robin tomorrow about how white people could use some more humility in the way they talk about race, and we're going to continue this conversation as we have been with other people as well, other points of view, and I'd like to hear from you. record@kuow.org, 221-3663. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and meanwhile, the Black Lives Matter movement is being turned into art at Seattle's Intimon Theater. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman says the BLM movement's co-founder is in town to help present local stories of institutional racism.
Luzviminda Uzeri Carpenter and a friend were driving north of Seattle this summer when their car stalled. Carpenter called 911 for help.
And we stood on the side of the sidewalk, and it was heavy traffic, and the cop rolled up on us. Didn't ask if we were okay. We were still fine for a moment. But the cop proceeded to ask a series of questions. We responded, asked again. We responded with the same thing, and they just didn't believe us.
Carpenter, who also goes by the name Lulu Nation, describes herself as Black, Filipina, and large. She says the female officer who responded to the 911 call became agitated and put her hand on her gun. Lulu Nation was terrified for her life, and months later, she's still afraid.
When I think about it, it's really, really hard. And that feeling sits in my bones every time I try for it not to. It sits in my bones every time I'm in front of a cop. Even if I'm angry, even if I'm mad, I have to remain calm and make myself small so that they're not scared of me when they have a gun.
This is just one of the stories that will be part of the Seattle production of Power, From the Mouths of the Occupied. The show was created in 2014 by Patrice Kahn Cullors, the co-founder of the National Black Lives Matter movement. At the time, Cullors was an artist in residence at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. It was 1 month after Michael Brown was killed by police near St. Louis.
And I was curious about what it would look like to develop a piece that would bring normal, regular black folk to tell their stories and develop a performance piece around it. And Kalamazoo was the experiment.
Cullors recruited people, then helped them to shape and perform their stories. The show evoked a great response from both the audience and the participants. So Cullor decided to recreate Power from the Mouths of the Occupied in her hometown, Los Angeles. Seattle is the third city in what Cullors hopes will become an ongoing national tour.
I can literally go to any part of the country, pick a crop of black people, and they will have very similar stories of criminalization.
In Seattle, Cullors has worked with Intimon and with local artist C. Davida Ingram to assemble a cast of 9 people to tell their stories.
Black folks are often going through such ugly, ugly things. And the only way that I was able to metabolize the ugliness was to make art.
The philosophy and what she believes is embodied in her.
Lulu Nation.
And so she's able to communicate that, not in big, like, oh, you know, let me tell you about the truth. It's more of like affirming.
The writing and editing work for this performance has all been done behind closed doors. Cullors and the storytellers wanted to develop mutual trust among the participants before they unveiled these stories to an audience. Lulu Nation says it won't be a typical evening at the theater.
I'm like hoping that people will just bear witness, kind of like it's okay that this happened and to acknowledge that it happened and that we don't have to be silent or hold it inside of our bodies.
Intimon Theater will present Power from the Mouths of the Occupied this week at the Langston Hughes Performing Arts Institute. From Seattle Central District, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
Hi, it's Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. On the day of the final presidential debate, I've got a question for you. What beliefs and attitudes contributed to the rise of Donald Trump as the Republican nominee? Berkeley sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild thinks she found some answers in rural Louisiana. She spent 5 years among low-income people there and documented her experience in a new book called Strangers in Their Own Land. Hochschild told KUOW's Ross Reynolds the political beliefs of poor white conservatives flow from their so-called deep story.
A deep story is a story of life as it feels like to you. You take the judgments out, you take the facts out. It's life as it feels, and we all have a deep story. But the deep story for the far-right people that I came to know was this. Imagine yourself waiting in line, a long line, like in a pilgrimage to the top of a hill where there is the American dream. You've been waiting for a long time. You've worked very hard for it. You have a sense of deserving, and the line is not moving. Then you see some people seem to cut ahead of you. And who are they? Well, they're immigrants, they're affirmative action blacks who want access to formerly all-white jobs, or women who want access to formerly all-male jobs. And then you see refugees, even public sector workers. These people seem to be cutting ahead of you and pushing you back when you haven't had a raise in 30 years, 20. And then they see in this deep story that President Obama and the Democratic Party is helping the line cutters. And then you see someone ahead of you in line turn around and say, oh, you ignorant redneck. And then that's it. You just feel ignored, dismissed, misunderstood, and you turn elsewhere for representation.
In your book, you describe the living conditions of these low-income white people in Louisiana to a degree that I didn't quite realize how bad it is for them. Could you talk a little bit about what's facing them day to day?
Yes, a keyhole issue in Strangers in Their Own Land is the environment. And I discovered that not only are red states poorer, have worse schools, medical care, families more disrupted, but they also live in more environmentally polluted lands. And they often have state regulatory systems that are weak because of the politicians they elect, so that they're living with more pollution. And so I asked one informant that I really got to know, a friend, why are you voting for Donald Trump? Because the one thing he's really clear about is that he wants to abolish the Environmental Protection Agency. How could you be suffering this much pollution? And in fact, he'd been evacuated from his community because of a drilling accident that could have been prevented. And he said, actually, I don't think Trump means it. Well, you know, then why is he saying it? He's saying it because he just wants to get people to vote for him. But when he's in office, he's not going to do that, he felt. And the oil part is really something important here, because the oil companies have seduced and captured the state. The state is giving, as gave, $1.5 billion to new oil and petrochemical plants coming in. And with that money, many of these companies are giving donations to the Audubon Society and school programs. So the companies are smelling like a rose. They seem to be the givers. Meanwhile, the state, because it is on bended knee to companies, is going light on regulation.
Are there questions that are still unanswered for you, having even spent all this time with them? Are there still things that puzzle you about their attitudes and their narration?
I think I do have the hang of how they think, but what puzzles me is why isn't there more attempt to be curious about people in a very different enclave, and why aren't we busy getting acquainted with people very different from ourselves? Because I think there's a lot of crossover we could get to. For example, this man I was just telling you about lost his home and community to a drilling accident, and voting for Trump, who wants to abolish the EPA. That man said, you know, we ought to get money out of politics. I thought, well, that's a good left-right crossover issue. And he also said, you know, we need to reduce prison populations. I mean, this is a lot of nonviolent crimes. Let's get people back to the community so they can be good fathers and mothers to their kids. Okay, that's another one. And let's clean up the environment. This man has become an environmentalist. And why isn't that a good crossover issue?
Talking with KUOW's Ross Reynolds there, that's author Arlie Russell Hochschild, and her new book is called Strangers in Their Own Land, and it's just been nominated for a National Book Award. Hochschild is going to be talking in Seattle this coming Tuesday evening, so you can hear her yourself. Seattle Public Library, Tuesday the 25th at 7 o'clock. Speaking of Donald Trump supporters, as we just were, Trump meets Hillary Clinton tonight in Las Vegas for their final debate. You're going to hear that live here on KUOW beginning at 6 o'clock. And we'll also be covering the debate today on KUOW's All Things Considered. The moderator of the debate is Chris Wallace, who works for Fox News. So we'll talk about the questions that does or doesn't raise about his objectivity. Also, this is going to be the first election in 50 years where federal monitors will not be in key polling stations. That's thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court. You'll learn about that. All that on KUOW's All Things Considered. Join us for the debate tonight starting at 6, and tomorrow we will react to that final debate. New York Times columnist Tim Egan, who's based in Seattle, he's going to be our guest tomorrow right here in the noon hour on KUOW's The Record. Can we leave politicians for a moment and just talk about rats? Because if you live in Seattle, I think you've seen a rat or two. It's quite common. According to a 2013 American Housing Survey, Seattle households are twice as likely to report rat sightings compared to the national average. Well, that prompted a question for KUOW's Local Wonder.
My name is Susan Roxborough, and I live in the Green Lake neighborhood of Seattle. And I'm wondering why there are so many rats living in Seattle.
Good question, Susan. We assigned it to our environment reporter, Ashley Ahern.
Turns out to answer the question, why are there so many rats in Seattle, I have to meet a guy in a back alley behind the University of Washington bookstore. It's about 9:30 at night. There's trash overflowing from a row of dumpsters nearby. And then my guy arrives. Adam Truitt, age 37, occupation, rat killer extraordinaire. Adam started his company Pest Fighter 8 years ago. He takes on all kinds of icky creatures, from yellow jackets to bed bugs. He had to deal with a nasty frat house full of those things the other day. But most people call him about rats.
It's been absolutely crazy lately. Like, just today I got like 10 calls.
About rats?
Just for rats alone. Yeah, just today. And that's one, you know, one business in Seattle, you know?
There are several reasons Seattle has a lot of rats. But top of the list is us and the trash we create. So this alleyway and hundreds of others like it around the city is the perfect place to find rats.
I mean, it's like a buffet for the rodents, basically, and it's all over town. I mean, all you gotta do is drive around at 9:30 at night and you can see rats running everywhere.
There are so many rats here that Adam says it's more efficient to shoot them with an air pressure pellet gun than to trap them.
Kind of like a bicycle pump, huh?
That might sound cruel, but I talked to the King County Department of Health and they said a pellet gun brings a quicker death than a slow poisoning.
Okay.
And it would take a lot of poison to kill all the rats in this alley.
I've already got about 45 of these out of here, so there's a lot less than there used to be. So I don't know how many we're going to actually get today, but...
We'll get back to the rat hunt in just a minute. But first, if you want to talk rats, where else do you call but New York City? A place known for the size and aggressiveness of its rat residents. The first rat infestation was documented there in the 1750s.
Hello?
Hey, Jason?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, how are you? Jason Munshie South studies the genetics of Manhattan rats at Fordham University, which means he traps rats all over the Big Apple.
We've trapped a rat that was well over 600 grams, you know, which is, you know, getting over a pound.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it was quite a monster.
That was a Norway rat, the same kind we have in Seattle. They're the most common type of rat in cities all over the world. But they didn't actually come from Norway.
It was a misnomer. The story is that Carl Linnaeus, who's a very famous taxonomist, he was Swedish, and he named the rat the Norway rat to get in a dig at Norwegians. But some people dispute that version of the story.
Unlike New York, which only has Norway rats, Seattle has two kinds. We've got the Norway rat, which tends to be bigger and stick to the ground. Those guys burrow and hang out in sewers and subways. But we also have the roof rat, or black rat. They tend to have bigger ears and longer tails that help them balance better as they climb trees and vines. Which brings us to our next reason Seattle has a lot of rats. We have lots of good habitat for both kinds of rats.
Definitely the more green space you have, like soft soil available for burrowing, the more rats you can have.
Seattle, like New York, is booming right now. Tens of thousands of people are moving to the area every year, which means more trash to feed the rats. But it also means more construction. Old houses or run-down abandoned properties are popular rat hangouts. And when those buildings are torn down, Jason says you'll see a rat exodus. And then they'll try to colonize other homes in the neighborhood.
It can be difficult because it only takes one property on a neighborhood scale to be the source or reservoir of rats.
A reservoir of rats. Okay, on to our last reason for the rise of rats. Climate change. During the cold winter months, rats take a break from making babies and just try to survive. A lot of them don't make it. But Jason said last winter was mild in New York, and he was seeing rats not only surviving, but breeding in late December.
So when the spring rolls around, you're already going to have a lot of rats, and then they're just going to reproduce even more. So it makes it harder to control their population when it's warmer.
That explanation definitely rings true for Adam Truitt, our rat killer here in Seattle. He told me a long warm season is a big problem because rats are really good at breeding. A female rat can give birth every 3 weeks.
And they can be pregnant the next day. And they usually have about 6 to 9 babies.
Wow.
Whoa. Yeah, so that's why they can breed so fast. They say they can have up to 150 descendants a year, which is a lot.
I follow Adam up the alley.
See, they're coming from this building right here on the right.
He clutches his pellet gun and gets down on his hands and knees. His headlight beams into the dark crevices under the dumpsters. The whole place reeks.
Oh, we got one coming. Ah. Oh, he's coming towards you.
Oh, there's one right there.
Ah! The rat was huge, but the scariest thing was its attitude. It practically stood its ground.
Do you think you got him?
I must have. He's not moving in there anymore.
It's getting late, and we've only seen a handful of rats, so Adam packs up his pellet gun and starts to head back to his truck.
But, I mean, this is good, because there's not a lot of them running around. I mean, when we first got here, they were everywhere. I mean, every time I turned my head, there was another one. Bam, bam, bam. And now it seems like there's the same, you know, three or four running around. You're good at watching for them, too.
Next career.
Yeah.
You need an assistant?
Truitt says the best way to keep rats out of your house is to seal up all the holes, even the little ones. A full-grown rat can squeeze through a hole the size of a quarter. And keep your compost covered and your trash tidy and out of reach of rodents. But between climate change, construction, lots of green space, and more people and trash, Seattle's future looks ratty. In a back alley in U District, I'm Ashley Ahern for KUOW's Local Wonder.
And remember, that story was inspired by a question from listener Susan Roxborough. And you can hear more stories from our Local Wonder series at KUOW.org. While you're there, you can take our rat trivia quiz. I scored a Templeton. You might have a reaction to the sight of rat killing. You can also leave us your own Local Wonder question about the Puget Sound region. And if we choose your question, we'll put a KUOW reporter on the case. This is Bill Radke. Do you remember the story of the Tacoma woman who became known as Drunk Teacher?
Tonight, no one answered the door at the home of former Larchmont Elementary teacher Clara Bowman. Bowman was fired from her job last week after Tacoma public school officials say she was found drunk in front of a classroom full of kindergartners.
Bowman's story was all over the national news earlier this year, and she was ridiculed on social media. But in the Tacoma News Tribune, columnist Matt Driscoll asked for compassion. He wrote that this teacher, this human being, was clearly in a deep, life-threatening struggle with alcohol. Well, Clara Bowman never returned to work, and a few months later she died by suicide. That is when columnist Matt Driscoll decided he wanted to tell the story, the full story, of how Bowman ended up drunk in front of that classroom. So he went to Spokane, where she grew up.
In many ways, her childhood was perfect. You know, when I'm sitting there in the living room with Tom and Robin, her parents, and they're telling stories of her teaching make-believe classes to her dolls and you know, and later her little sister, and having neighborhood kids over to the house and, you know, playing school there and, you know, always being the teacher. I mean, it really seems like it was picture perfect in so many ways, but the big takeaway from Clara's childhood was the death of her sister from leukemia when Clara was 14 and her sister was 10. It was, a life-changing event for the entire family, but one that certainly seemed to have an effect on Clara.
As her parents looked back, what do they remember about how Clara coped or had trouble coping with her sister's death?
Well, both her parents and I spoke with friends who grew up with her, and the main picture I got was of someone who just coped by filling her life with activity. I mean, she was already an outgoing, active person, you know, in school and her social life, but from what I understand, when her sister passed, it just amped up. I mean, she was just busy constantly with whether it was school activities or social life activities. She just was filled her life with activity. And, you know, of course, that's the thing about this story is we're looking at it in retrospect, and now you can make all these connections that I'm sure were difficult to make at the time. But the way it's told to me is, you know, now that's kind of seen as a coping mechanism. And she was also the type of person who didn't want people to be unhappy. So I think she shouldered a lot of the burden of kind of being, you know, being a person who could lift other people up in that time of tragedy and their strength and staying busy and appearing happy. And so there was that. And then, of course, also her parents say that she started drinking at 15, so a year after her sister's death. And You know, at the time, again, I think her parents probably viewed that as pretty typical high school stuff. I mean, she was still excelling in school and you know, all these outward signs, wasn't having a problem yet. But she started drinking at 15, and there's a quote in the story, her mom's telling of Clara describing that first experience with alcohol and, you know, just how much she loved it. And her mom's takeaway from that is it was numbing the pain. So I think she went to, you know, like so many alcoholics or folks dealing with significant trauma, I think she went to great lengths to kind of hide it, and there was also a self-medication factor there. So,
fast forward to when Clara Bowman is an adult teaching kindergarten in Tacoma. She was discovered drunk in her classroom not one time, but two times at least, first in February 2011 and then again in February of 2016. And it sounds like February might not have been a coincidence.
That's certainly the interpretation of friends and family. Her sister, Brita, passed away in late January, and that was known to be kind of a difficult anniversary for Clara throughout her life. You know, I heard a lot of stories about, you know, just even dating back to college about how she was known to struggle during that time of year, disappear, drinking would increase. Friends kind of came to almost expect it, or they certainly were aware of it. And so, like I said, I think that was kind of a lifelong burden she carried.
Matt, all of us have some kind of pain, and most of us don't get blackout drunk in front of a kindergarten classroom. How do you feel about a reader who was angry about that and expressed that anger on social media?
No, I understand it. I mean, that's one of the things about this story is, you know, I mean, some of the reaction I've gotten is, why did we cover it at all? Why did news organizations cover it at all? And I mean, I want to be clear. I think it was, you know, and I think Clara's parents agree with this too. I mean, I think we all understand why it was news. I mean, here in Tacoma, it was a story. I mean, she's a public employee. She's a kindergarten teacher. She's responsible for a class full of 5- and 6-year-olds, and in the midst of her disease was making incredibly poor decisions that potentially put those kids in danger. And so I certainly understand the anger reaction there. I think that's natural. This was something that happened, and it was a story that had to be told. But I think, you know, once you go outside of Tacoma, I think that line becomes a little less clear. I mean, was it news in Denver? Was it news in New York? I'm not so sure. And again, I mean, I think those of us who work in the media kind of understand the way these things sometimes develop. The way the salacious details started kind of leading the story, I think that's what was problematic for me, was the story just kind of took on a life of its own, and all of a sudden you've got media outlets tweeting out, you know, all the sort of details, you know, find out at 10 just how drunk the Tacoma teacher was. I mean, yes, it was news, but did it have to be reported the way it was, and what was the motivation for doing so? And, you know, I think a lot of times the motivation for doing so is just the obvious, increasing viewership, increasing clicks on the internet, and, you know, that's a problematic practice sometimes, I think.
Well, why would that sordid detail telling of the story, why would that increase viewership? In other words, what is it about us that that's what we wanted the story to be?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know. Does it make us feel better to vilify this woman in the middle of her disease? I don't know. I mean, is it just something that we're so detached from it that it seems funny? You know, look how drunk this woman was. Oh my, you know, how many bottles did she have? I don't know the answer to that, but I think we've seen it enough times to know it's a pattern.
Well, it's a weird relationship with alcohol and drugs that we have, that it's funny until it's not.
Right. I spoke to a number of experts, and the kind of what I kept hearing is, you know, we've normalized risky drinking behaviors, unhealthy drinking behaviors, and that's kind of become a normally accepted thing in our society until someone like Clara Bowman has real struggles with it, real issues with it, and then all of a sudden she's vilified and becomes a punchline for being unable to deal with it. And I think that's, you know, there are questions for all of us in this story, not just the media. And I think, you know, from a societal perspective, that's one of the big ones, is about our relationship to alcohol and drugs, and how we've kind of normalized these things until somebody really struggles, and then they almost become an outcast.
You wrote back when she was fired that you hoped Clara Bowman would get help, and it looked like she was getting help.
Yeah, shortly after the firing, She did an inpatient program in Yakima, and it wasn't her first attempt at sobriety. She'd done AA. She'd done a number of things throughout her entire life, but like is so often the case, unfortunately, it didn't stick for her, and that's one of the tragedies here.
What do we know about how she came to die?
You know, she was found at a motel in Kent. You know, I think the medical examiner ruled it a suicide from a mix of alcohol and various over-the-counter and prescription drugs. And, you know, that's a ruling that, you know, everyone reluctantly kind of accepts at this point. Just a really sad story.
Matt, Clara Bowman's parents opened up to you to not only retell Clara's story, but to tell it in a fuller way. What's been accomplished? What matters about us learning the truth about Clara?
Yeah. To me and to her parents, it goes back to that humanizing factor, I think. In the midst of that story of her firing and when she was national news for 2 days back in March, you know, you didn't see a human. You just saw a headline. You just saw a punchline, and that was difficult for the parents to deal with, and it was difficult for me to accept. And furthermore, I mean, for me personally, the way it ended, to have gotten the first half of the story about her firing and the mistakes, and kind of have that be the story of her without knowing how the story ended, it just seemed incredibly unfair. So, I mean, hopefully now we have a picture of Clara Bowman as a person who a lot of people cared a lot about, who was really good at her job, who struggled incredibly with alcohol and trauma and depression and anxiety and other things. You know, we add a level of humanity to that story that was previously missing.
Matt Driscoll, columnist for the Tacoma News Tribune, telling you the fuller story of Clara Bowman, more than the drunk teacher you might have heard about earlier this year. Research shows 90% of people who die by suicide also suffer from some kind of substance abuse or mental health disorder. And again, we've said it before, if you or somebody you know needs help, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And that phone number is 800-273-TALK, 800-273-8255. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. You are going to help decide whether Washington State gets a carbon tax. It's on your fall ballot, so you might want to look north and find out how the carbon tax has gone in British Columbia. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill. It's going well.
Good, good, yeah.
Nobody likes taxes, but this one, you know, brought in 2008. We've had two provincial elections since then, and nobody's suggested going back on it. And there's a couple of things about our carbon tax that people like. The first one, and I gather this is also what you're looking at in Washington State, is that it was offset here in BC with other tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So the government cut income taxes, they cut some business taxes, and they set up an auditing system so that the tax cuts equal what the carbon tax is bringing in. That's helped a lot. The pricing has been gradual, too. You know, we started off at a penny or two per liter of gas, so multiply that by four, and you've got it what it is in Canadian dollars. And we're now up to, it's about 7 cents a liter, so figure 30 cents Canadian a gallon. And it's, of course, calculated the same way that you're proposing in Washington State. It's actually worked out as so many dollars per metric ton or per ton of emissions. Carbon emissions. It's applied to other sort of fossil fuel burning as well, home heating, things like that. And again, there are offsets. So, you know, the revenue neutrality has worked. And the other thing that has worked is it has not hurt the British Columbia economy, near as anybody can tell. British Columbia is currently leading Canada in both economic growth and in job creation. So as public policy initiatives go, I would put this one down as a big success.
In British Columbia, the carbon tax had to be revenue neutral by law. In Washington State, it is part of the controversy over it because there are people who feel that what we don't need is a revenue neutral. First of all, that might be a rosy projection, but also that a carbon tax ought to raise money to help the people who are hurt most by climate change. So we're having that fight right now at the ballot in Washington State.
Yes, I recognize that there's a bit of a debate around it. As I said, I think here one of the keys to building public support was that we're going to put a price on carbon. The idea is we're going to put a price on carbon. We're going to provide a reverse economic incentive for emissions, and we're going to tax emissions. But we're not going to try to accomplish other public policy objectives at the same time. The government's going to build transit lines as they are in British Columbia. Well, that'll be paid for separately. We're going to focus on taxing pollution, and that's what we've done. And it kept it simple. I recognize that there are other opportunities, other ideas, cap and trade, all sorts of things. You sometimes hear suggestions here in BC that the government should raise the carbon tax and use that money for retrofitting and so forth. The government did offer some a low-income cash transfer for people on fixed incomes and low incomes. They did offer another bonus or an offset for home heating oil in parts of the province where people use a lot of that. And some of that is paid for out of the carbon tax revenues as well.
Vaughn, on another subject, have I thanked you for the love note your country sent us this week?
Come here, you big lummox. You need a hug, right?
Let's hear a little of the hug. I'll play a little bit of it, and you can tell us the story behind it, will you?
What's up, America?
Hey, guys. We're just up here in Canada talking about how great you guys are down there. We thought we'd just send you a little bit of a love note.
We know you've got some really big decisions to make. But as you're thinking about your future, we just want you to know that
you guys are great.
You really are great. All your diversity and all your openness.
The fact that you're such a giving nation, over $250 billion a year is donated to charities.
Okay, I'm starting to blush. Let's leave that there. But this was a nice little note from Canadians saying, America, you already are great.
Okay, so let's just say that we meant well, right? But I do have to give you the counter view, which was Jimmy Kimmel last night said he thought it was the most insulting thing he had seen, right? Okay, you know, maybe this isn't the best presidential election in American history, but let's not get patronizing about it. Americans do not need a hug from Canada. And he thought the whole thing was kind of insulting. All I will say, Bill, is that we meant well. Our hearts are in the right place, even if it does sound sort of patronizing when you think about it.
I never had a doubt. And listen, let me return the favor by saying go Blue Jays. Toronto won a game finally and is still hanging in there in the playoffs.
Hanging by the fingernails. I don't know. What do you think? Chicago Cubs at the end of it all?
Well, that would be a big story down here. So either way, somebody's going to be happy. We appreciate the hug, and Vaughn Palmer, great to talk with you.
Bye-bye, Ben.
Thank you. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in today. One more thing. You know how we call our nation's capital the other Washington? Well, we might have to start calling it the other state of Washington, because yesterday the D.C. City Council approved a ballot measure to turn that city into America's 51st state, and it would be called the State of Washington, D.C., as if having two Washingtons isn't confusing enough. What are people going to call us? The State of Washington, not D.C.? The State of Washington, period? They can't do this to us. And they probably won't. Not soon, because Congress would have to go along and Republicans control both houses and they would never admit another blue state voluntarily. But what if the Republicans get swamped in November? Hillary Clinton has said she would be a, quote, vocal champion for D.C. statehood. Or as we'd call it, the state of other Washington. This is KUOW's The Record.